Okay, so today on the Loopcast, on the 27th episode of the Loopcast, I'm talking with Nahid Mustafa, and we will sort of we're talking about the impact of drones in Pakistan. So, you know, we had a conversation with Joshua Faust about drone strategy and drone policy, and then we had a conversation with Benjamin Wittes about drone law. So those conversations were very much 25,000 feet above, you know, in the air, you know, quite literally. So today we're going to try to sort of look at the drone war and sort of drones, not from top down, but from the bottom up, and sort of look at, you know, its political impact, its domestic impact on Pakistan, you know, one of the more famous sort of theaters where drones are used, you know, maybe second or equal to Yemen. So let's start. So let's start at the very like basic level. What is, you know, walk us through the aftermath of a drone strike, and, you know, where have the drones struck the most in Pakistan? You know, what is an aftermath and the location of the drone war?
Well, I think what you'll find, I mean, in terms of reporting, let's assume that that drone strikes by and large do end up getting reported at some level or another. It's not always necessary that they will, simply because some of them are so remote, or some of them have been on, a completely isolated mountain road. And so it doesn't really get taken up much, even in local media in Pakistan either. But in general terms, yes, it does get reported. It gets picked up by a wide variety of media outlets. And you will see some pretty extensive reporting, particularly as you get closer and closer to sort of the epicenter of the strike. I think what you'll find in general, I mean, just to kind of pull back a little bit, the tribal areas within the context of Pakistan are also fairly isolated. You don't find that, I mean, it's not a place where Pakistanis will find themselves in terms of those who don't actually live in the region. It's hard to get into. The law isn't the same in the tribal areas, and it's a fairly hard place to get information out of. Now, that doesn't mean information doesn't get out. People do travel back and forth. People do go into the cities, into Peshawar, into Islamabad, and various places. Reporters, especially the reporters who live and work in the tribal areas, they've done a lot of work in terms of documenting what happens. There have been local citizens, kind of, if you want to consider it like citizen journalism, who have documented this in photographs and in sort of oral testimonies. And I think what you'll find in general is that there's sort of two things that happen. So when you have a strike where there is a lot of civilian casualties, then what you'll find is that there is a reaction to that, a response to that at a local level. So you will see protests, you will see a lot of anger, you will see people speaking out about it. In strikes where it's generally understood that the people who have been killed in it are not... it's so hard to use the term militant, because then again, we have to get into all these definitions about what militant means. But I think what you'll find in general, in terms of the reporting, people don't tend to get riled up. It becomes very much a sort of, an event that's happened locally that does get reported, but there isn't as much sort of emotion and upset from the citizens, from the local residents. There have been reports, of course, that when there is a strike, that it becomes difficult to access the site, because if somebody sort of in the higher up in the pecking order in terms of one of the local insurgent groups is taken out, the local insurgents do sort of cordon off the area, and it's difficult to sort of suss out what exactly has happened and who has died. And so I would say that a lot of what comes out of there in terms of information initially can be hard to verify. That doesn't mean that it can't be verified. And I think that you'll see that there have been a lot of people who've been able to get in there, get, you know, kind of verify some basic details, get names to a large extent, and understand, who's dying and, you know, and what those numbers are saying in a limited way, but certainly in a way that can be extrapolated to give us a larger sense of the picture.
I mean, does that make it problematic, though? I mean, if if you're having difficulty assigning not just how many people have died, but who has died. I mean, do you see that as, I mean, is that problematic for, not only as a reporter, but it almost seems like it's also problematic for the government of Pakistan, because if, the US is coming in there, you don't know if you've killed an insurgent or you've just killed sort of innocent people. I mean, walk us through that. I mean, how does the government of Pakistan deal with, this rather imprecise, science of targeting?
I think it's absolutely problematic, and it's not just problematic for media or the Pakistani government. I think it's also highly problematic for the American government. I think if the entire policy is premised on the idea that this is helping to forward a particular strategy, a particular outcome for the U.S. government, and the numbers are not supporting that, then I think that clearly that's a discussion that obviously is going to be taken up in a different way in the US, but it's a discussion obviously that needs to be had. And we've seen numbers come out recently that, through the McClatchy report that came out, I guess it's been maybe a month or 6 weeks, something like that, where they've been able to see through some data that it's probably about less than 2% of the victims of drone strikes are actually senior Al-Qaeda members. If you look at the stats coming out of the Bureau of Investigative Journalism out in the UK, they've sort of in terms of how much they've been able to suss out, and certainly they've been able to sort of sort out enough details that one can comfortably extrapolate into a broader picture that the vast majority of people who are killed are sort of these low-level militants, these part-time militants who might sort of take up arms on the weekend and sort of carry on that way. And so yeah, that question has to get taken up in terms of all of the possible outcomes of this, not just in terms of goals for the US, but also in terms of broader relations and perceptions. Is it worthwhile if you're actually only ending up with 2% of the people that 2% of the victims in this are people that you're actually gunning for, literally. And maybe the answer for the US is yeah, that's fine. And maybe the answer is no. So that's one side of it. The other side of it, I think that one thing that doesn't get taken up, I think, in a lot of media reporting is the idea of the Pakistani government and its connection to the drone campaign. And I think that, the Pakistani government, the civilian government is probably, in my estimation, a bit of a bit player in the whole conversation around drones in Pakistan. It's not really the purview of the Pakistani government to have made these decisions. These were decisions that were initially made under Musharraf, who General Musharraf, who obviously was a military dictator. And the conversation is one, to whatever limited extent a conversation is happening, is really one that's between the American government and the Pakistani military. And so, my sense of it is that in terms of numbers and statistics, that the Pakistani military and intelligence probably has a far greater handle on who's dying and who's not, and have far better numbers than the Pakistani government would ever have. And they probably have better numbers, or at least as good numbers as the CIA would have. And so this idea that somehow there is a lack of knowledge on the part of the Pakistanis, if we're going to use that as a way to refer to sort of the deep state. I don't think that's true. I think that the intelligence and the military have a much stronger idea of what's happening there than the civilian government does, and sort of the broader civilian citizenry does. I would dispute the idea that somehow Pakistanis are entirely in the dark about this.
So before we get into sort of the politics of, drone strikes, how do you, what is your feeling about how drone strikes are portrayed in Western media in Pakistan versus Pakistani media? Because I feel like, being in the United States and really, being only exposed, me, only exposed, to the drone campaign in Pakistan through, the Washington Post, BBC, so forth and so on, I feel like I only get one sort of perspective, on the drone war in Pakistan. So help us walk us through, how is it portrayed, and what are the differences, and what do you feel like are the differences between how this, you know, this type of warfare is portrayed in the Pakistani media versus, you know, the Western media writ large.
Well, I think that a lot of the issues are probably not dissimilar from other kinds of reporting. It's difficult to really get a sense of the. It's difficult to get a sense, I think, of how people perceive this in terms of violation, because and that's just a logistical thing in part because there aren't that many reporters who are reporting on this from that first person perspective. I mean, certainly there's some good work that's being done, but I wouldn't say that by and large the American media or the Western media does a very good job in reporting about Pakistanis. It's an interesting question the way that you put it, and I guess my first answer to that would be to kind of turn it around, that if you had if you had a nation bombing the United States, and sort of bombing it at will, and regardless of what level of coordination was happening between the American military or the CIA and the second country that's bombing the US, say let's say bombing Wyoming or something, somewhere I don't know much about how sparse Wyoming is, but my sense of it is that it's not a very densely populated area. So let's say there's a place that's not what that's a bit sparsely populated, and most Americans are not going there. And this place is getting bombed. Well, what would be the perception of Americans? And at the end of the day, I suspect that the idea that there is some level of coordination between some secret element and the second country to come to an agreement about bombing American citizens, I don't think that that would necessarily placate Americans in general. And I think that that's a similar it's a similar thing. I think the idea that there isn't a debate about drones, I don't think that that really gets taken up very well in the American media because Pakistanis are often portrayed as sort of this monolith, right? You kind of have this large mass of really sort of, brooding and angry, probably sweaty brown people. And then you have like this tiny minority of, liberal-minded, educated people who can kind of see the logic of the American way. And I think that that does a real disservice to some of the really interesting conversations that are happening in Pakistan around this. I think ultimately what it is, it is seen as a violation of sovereignty. And I don't think that it gets taken up necessarily in terms of whether it's something that's been allowed. I think the idea that when when you have that discussion and you say, well, this is something that the Pakistan military has allowed, or this is something that the intelligence services have allowed, there's a level of collusion between the state and the United States in terms of allowing this to happen. That doesn't placate anyone. I think people are still outraged at it, rightly so. At the same time, certainly there are people within Pakistan who don't sort of have a blanket condemnation of drone use. Their point is, well, the people that are dying in this, even if they're low-level militants, certainly aren't serving the Pakistani state very well. I guess the question that gets taken up as a second question in Pakistan is really whether this type of summary killing is something that a sort of a fledgling democracy like Pakistan should and ought to accept. It's so easy to kill people, and get away with it. And is this something that as a nation they want to endorse, especially if it's happening on their own soil? So I think that the response is a lot more nuanced than what you'll get just by reading American media. I think that there are some people that are having, really interesting and nuanced discussions about it. I don't think that you would get a sense of that just by reading American papers or Canadian papers for that matter.
Okay, let me shift a little and, you know, to, you know, as a broad question, you know, how has the drone war sort of shaped, you know, Pakistani politics? Because it seems like, you know, from your answer that you have the civilian-led government. I think it's Asif Zardari, right? That's the head of the civilian government. And then you
Well,
have,
it's a caretaker government now, so.
oh, it's a character. Okay, right, because you have elections coming up.
Right.
But it seems like you have that the civilian portion, and then you have the military and the intelligence services that seem to consent to the, you know, drones operating in Pakistani airspace and Pakistani land. So I'm curious then, how does this balance itself? What is the argument that the civilian government can make or should make, towards the military and the intelligence services? And then what is the sort of counter argument that the military makes? I mean, is this, is really the military, I guess it really boils down, does the military have more control over Pakistani sovereignty than the civilian government? Or is it really, it's this nuanced sense of argumentation and, back and forth?
Well, I think that, to get an answer to that, you really have to go back to the sort of the really early days. I think that specifically with respect to the relationship between Pakistan and the United States, it's really by and large a relationship that's existed between the United States and the Pakistan military. I don't think that the relationship between the US and any of Pakistan's civilian governments has ever been as well developed and as close as the Americans' relationship with Pakistan military. Within Pakistan, there's also, I think, a sense in general that the military can do whatever it wants, and that the civilian government is really in a position of kind of there's a certain deference that exists, right? I mean, the civilian government can negotiate all kinds of sort of things with the Indians or with the Afghans or whatever it wants to do, but the ultimate veto rests in the hands of the Pakistan military. And you'll hear all kinds of stories about about the need that the Pakistan military has. I mean, its entire lens is really one of maintaining the integrity of the borders, right? I mean, it isn't really one that's focused on sort of institutional development, civilian institutional development or anything like that. It's really in the business of building itself up. It's one of the largest corporations in Pakistan. I mean, it's got some of the best schools. I think there's still a wide perception that it is probably the least corrupt institution in the country. And so the military isn't a separate entity. I mean, if you're in the US or if you're in Canada, and obviously I'm a Canadian, so I can speak from the Canadian perspective on this, that we don't generally run into military people in our daily lives, right? I mean, it's odd for me to see a soldier on the streets, and it's usually somebody with his duffel bag probably getting back to his base, getting on the train. I suspect that outside of certain towns in the US, it's probably similar. The military doesn't enter your daily life in a regular way. And that's not necessarily the case in Pakistan. There's a real nationalism around the military, as an institution, not necessarily as a fighting force, but I think that there's a real sense of pride that the average Pakistani has for the military. There's a sense of deference. I mean, when politics gets really, really bad, and when the situation feels a little untenable in terms of the violence and the killings, people start talking, we need martial law. We need to call in the military. And it's an across the board refrain. So it's not like you'll hear this from some particular quarter or from some fringe element. I mean, this is something that people default to on a regular basis, that, I think we should send in the troops. I think we should do this. I think we should do that. And it's not an odd conversation to have in that country because the military has been in charge for so long. And so to me, it's not odd to think that here's this incredibly contentious policy that's been negotiated almost entirely through the military and intelligence. And it's really one of informing the civilian government that this is a thing, that this policy exists, and this is how we will proceed on this matter. I think you'll see that General Kayani has been, who's the head of the military, he's been fairly reluctant to kind of wade into civilian politics. And it's hard to know what that means. It's hard to know whether that's, biding his time or whether that's some sort of signal for the long term. People have been speculating about the willingness of the military to let Pervez Musharraf go to trial. They don't want to wade into that either, even though initially there's a lot of speculation when he first came to Pakistan that regardless of his status and regardless of his lack of honor, that and that those are not my words, but that was sort of what Woolman was hearing, that the military wouldn't sort of quote unquote let him be prosecuted. And I think we've seen that that's not something that's turned out to be true. But I think that there is a general sense that if you creep too closely to crossing the line in terms of what the military wants, that you're going to know about it. And so, there's always been a certain level of deference to the military by the civilian governments and all of the civilian governments. And governments that survive are the ones that kind of really forge a close bond. And I think you'll see some of that rhetoric around Imran Khan as well, that one of the reasons he's been so successful. And of course, I'm not saying that this is necessarily factually true, but this is a lot of the chatter that you hear that, he's not one that's really sort of strongly opposed the military's position. That's not a criticism. I'm just saying that is that is something that comes up in conversation. So yeah, I think that this idea that somehow the civilian government has the upper hand, I don't think anyone really believes that.
So let me ask you this then. I mean, does the drone war sort of challenge Pakistan's democracy then, or fledgling democracy? Because it seems like in order to have the drone war, you need to have an entity in Pakistan consent to that. So, and if I understand it correctly, this is the military and the ISI, and if people are deferring to the military and ISI over, let's say, the civilian government, it seems like, that's can be interpreted as a challenge to Pakistan's sort of newish democracy. I mean, it seems like, how does this sort of work in terms of becoming a democracy?
Well, when I just want to correct one thing. When I say that people are deferring to the military, I don't mean that the citizens are that they are deferring to the military in terms of the drone campaign. I think that what you'll find is that civilian governments will, when it comes to matters of national security, defer to the military. That's just the way it's always been. That if the military doesn't want something in terms of when it comes to a sort of a national security platform, it's not going to happen. And I don't think that anyone's under any illusions about that. I think that Pakistanis in general have a sense that that's the case. Insofar as I mean, and one of the things that you have to understand too about Pakistan is that, there is a level of democracy that exists. I mean, Pakistan has, it has institutions that work at a certain level. It has organization that works at a certain level. I mean, if you look at the way that government, local governments work and provincial governments work, I mean, they work to a certain degree. That doesn't mean that patronage politics doesn't exist. But I would say that, there's a certain level of functionality that the government has, and the fact that people are excited about, about this change, about the fact that this is the first civilian government that's actually ever finished a term, and is transferring power through an election to another civilian government. I mean, this has never happened in the history of this country, and I think that there is a fair amount of excitement around that. I don't know that the thing is that this particular problem, the problem with drones in the tribal areas, I think in general it sits so far away from the life of the average Pakistani. I mean, not just in terms of the idea of it, but just the sort of even the geography of it, right? And this doesn't mean that Pakistanis are not empathetic. I think what you'll find though is that things have been so violent for so long in Fatah, and people in Fatah are faced with multiple oppressions. It's not just the drone war. I mean, there's a military campaign up there. There's tribal problems up there. There's gang problems and criminal activity. And so it's not like and at the same time, people obviously they live their lives. Their kids go to school. People fall in love and they get married, and all of those things happen as well. But I think in general, the whole idea of the tribal areas, it's so far removed from the daily lives of people that it doesn't really necessarily get taken up in terms of the stories of individuals, right? It gets taken up in a very politicized way. And, successive politicians have taken it up in a political way. That doesn't mean that they're not necessarily sincere about the way they feel about it. But I think that it's also a very good way to rile the masses, right? To kind of find a common rallying point. And I think you'll see that Imran Khan has done that really, really well.
So let's build on that point then. Pakistani elections are coming up on Saturday on May 11th. Is drone use sort of, does it rally? Does it, have people been able to use it to build a constituency? I mean, Imran Khan comes to mind because, he had his the Waziristan Peace March, or basically he, this was late last year, where he, for the audience to that he wanted to, protest civilian deaths, in South Waziristan. So my question is, has Imran Khan and others, have they been able to build a, successful constituency or voter base based on sort of rallying against, the use of drones in Pakistan?
I would say that, I mean, I think that we'll see that Imran Khan has probably been the most vocal, or at least the one who's gotten the most attention around his position on drones. I don't know that. I mean, that's certainly a position that resonates widely, regardless of political affiliation. I don't think that you can say that it's only members of his organization or followers of his party that or people that are planning to vote for him that actually have that position. I think that he's been one of the people that's been more successful at using it as a rallying point. But I'm not going to say that that's the only issue he's presented. I mean, he's running on a sort of his slogan. He uses the phrase Naya Pakistan, which means new Pakistan. And I think that that's really a point that sort of he's been able to capture the imagination. And I want to make very clear that I don't fly any political flags. I'm not, I don't sort of vote for any of these people, and I'm not a member of any of these parties. But I think that, he's one thing he has been successful at is sort of capturing the imagination of people. As far as, I mean, just to kind of go back a little bit, one time somebody asked me, if prosecutions in Pakistan were, tended to be political. So when a politician ended up with a criminal case, was that typically a political prosecution? And my response was that, the prosecutions are probably right and real, but the timing is always political, right? And so I think that that's a similar thing here, that I have no reason to think that Imran Khan, for example, or really anybody who's been speaking out against the use of drones is only using it as a political rallying point. I mean, there's no reason to think that. I would imagine, and I don't know Imran Khan, I've never spoken to him about this, but I would imagine that this is actually his, his actual position on it, just in terms of as a person. And it's something that he feels is something worth campaigning on. I don't think that that's the only thing that has people rallying around him. I don't think it's taken up that big a portion. I think that's something that Western media has taken up, and kind of given him some disproportionate attention on that particular issue, because that's the one issue that resonates over here. But I think he's been very clear that he's also sick and tired of corruption, and a lot of what he says is kind of a reflection of the average middle class Pakistani. And yeah, like I think that that's where that's coming from. And the interesting thing too, that if you talk about the position on drones, and like I said, I mean, I think that the closer you get to the epicenter of a strike, the more accurate the information, obviously. But I think that the closer that you get to a strike zone, the more nuanced the position on drones gets as well. Because if you look at some of the at some of the documentation that comes out of there, some of the interviews that come out of there, some of the cross-checking that's been done by various organizations, I think that you'll see that people in Fatah, in the tribal areas, they're not black and white on it, right? Because they live with this militancy problem on a daily basis. It's completely taken over their lives. And so if if there's someone that they know who's been engaging in this type of behavior and who's been tormenting them as well, gets taken out by a drone strike, it's not necessary that they're going to protest that drone strike. The protesting usually comes when there's been a civilian casualty or somebody who's been taken out along with someone who's got a militant background. And again, that term militant, needs better definitions. But yeah, I think that it's not a black and white position.
Now, I'm curious for civilian casualties, are they used politically, within Waziristan? Because it seems like, at least from a Western perspective, that Al-Qaeda and sort of the insurgency group, insurgent groups operating in that area sort of use the casualties, the civilian casualties to their advantage as a way of, at least perceived by a Westerner, be able to rally to an organization resisting the state, resisting the Pakistani state. I mean, is there something, is that accurate, or is that, in your experience, is that more, being played up by the media here in the United States?
I think that a lot of those lines that get drawn in a very sort of straight way, right? That someone's family gets taken out by a drone strike and then buddy signs up with Al-Qaeda. And I don't know that is, that is borne out by the statistics and by the information. I mean, you'll see lots of people who have had direct impacts of these strikes on their lives who have not taken up arms. People in the region are really caught, right? I mean, on the one side, they have the state, which has not really been friendly to them. It's not a place that's provided a great deal of comfort. Fatah is not ruled under Pakistani law. It has its own separate law, one that goes back to colonial times when the British were ruling the area, and it's not a law that's based in any way on a respect for sort of democratic freedoms and individual liberty. It's nothing like that. It's a law that's based on collective punishment, and a system that really gives precedence to the people who have power. And there's not a lot of recourse when the average person gets into trouble. And so that's the one side, right? The other side, you have a variety of insurgent actors. You have obviously remnants of Al-Qaeda. You have the TTP, the Pakistani Taliban. You have elements of of local insurgent groups. You have local gangs. You have criminals of a variety, and they can sometimes coalesce around an issue. You have intertribal issues, and you also have a lot of times local clashes, sort of security forces being as oppressive toward the local people as any of the insurgent groups. And so that is something I think that isn't really discussed much in Western media. So this idea that somehow you've got these people out there who have no recourse but to sign up with Al-Qaeda, I don't think that that's accurate. And I don't think that that's true. I think that most people just want to live their lives. And I think that most people living in those situations are very pragmatic about what they need to do. And it's not an exact analogy, but I think that, there was better reporting on this in southern Afghanistan, for example, which isn't too far from the area that we're talking about, that local populations say, on the one side, we've got the American military who harasses us if we don't tell them what they want to hear. And on the other side, we have the Taliban who harasses us if we don't tell them what they want to hear. And so we just tell people what they want to hear. And I think that you'll find a similar perspective in Fatah, that people just want to be left alone. At the same time, they are forced to kind of negotiate their way through militant groups and through security forces. And in addition to drone strikes, there are airstrikes as well by the Pakistan military. So this isn't a place where it's peaceful all the time, except for drone strikes. There's a whole lot going on there. Do militant groups use civilian casualties to rally people and for propaganda purposes? Of course they do. I mean, I would imagine any insurgent group worth its salt would do that. Militaries do that, governments do that. I would be surprised if they didn't do that. Does it actually have the impact of quote unquote turning people over? I'm sure there have been cases, but I would not say that that's something that exists as a trend. That hasn't been borne out in my interviews with journalists up there or with people that are working with drone strike victims. That hasn't borne itself out in any of the stuff that I've read. That's data that's been collected by other organizations, or by people that live in the area. People are just trying to get by.
Is there a danger of sort of local grievances, being played up and then, with the end result being a strike? For example, I think, I think it was in Iraq where you would, have one guy go to the US or to, the security forces and say, well, my next door neighbor is Al Qaeda, or my next door neighbor is planning an attack. And so that gets fed up the security chain, which results in sort of a drone strike or an airstrike or whatever. But, do local grievances and sort of local tensions, feed into the drone war, into strikes, or is it really just, outside, the security forces and the United States or whomever identifying people and then killing them? Because it seems like, there's a lot of gray in this regard.
Right. I think that you will probably find, I haven't actually heard that as being a huge problem in this particular area. This was a problem, you'll find that that tends to be a problem, sometimes at the very local level when you have, a variety of sort of Taliban type actors, right? And so we saw this, for example, in Swat when the TTP was in Swat, and people were using them as a way to kind of get back at people and get revenge and that kind of thing, for perceived wrongs and that sort of thing. In Fatah, what ends up happening typically is that there's sort of these two types of strikes, right? Like there's the strike that sort of comes out of intelligence, and that sort of this person is in this place, and this is we need to take this person out. And then there are signature strikes, which are more about looking at behavior of groups of people, and if that behavior is perceived to fall into what one perceives as being militant behavior, then you strike that area. And that's problematic because what does one see as militant type behavior? I mean, if it's a young man of a certain age carrying a gun, well, surprise, surprise, lots of young men of a particular age carry guns in that part of the world. And again, I mean, that's a question that has to get taken up. So, you might have, for example, somebody who ends up getting pointed to as a militant, because his brother is a militant, but he himself might be a teacher, or someone who runs a shop, and his uncle is a well-known, sort of foot soldier for the Taliban, or sort of worked fixing cars for somebody else, for an insurgent group. And I think that a lot of those things don't get parsed out. But I think one of the problems that ends up coming up is how it gets reported after the fact. Like, I think that there are a lot of efforts to kind of backtrack and justify a strike. And I think one of the most telling moments was when we initially heard how the Obama administration defines militant. And it was such a broad and ridiculous definition, as to be absolutely meaningless. It was basically that if there is a strike, they were counting militants according to how many military-aged men in the strike zone were killed, and therefore everyone who's been killed or injured, they were a militant. And there's so many obvious problems with that kind of definition. And so, so does that play out at a local level? Does someone finger somebody as a militant because they have some kind of rivalry? I'm sure that happens. I haven't come across that as being an explicit problem that's not to say that that doesn't exist. I'm not going to claim to have sort of an exhaustive knowledge of what's happening. But I will say that in all of the interviews that I've done and all of the people that I've talked to, this particular problem, as we've heard it happen in Iraq and as we've heard it happen in Afghanistan, isn't necessarily a glaring issue in Fatah. You know, just because it's not getting reported doesn't mean that it's not happening. You know, I don't know, maybe it is happening and not just getting reported. Maybe it's actually not a problem because of the sort of the difference in how these types of things happen. Maybe it's not happening because there's better intelligence. Maybe that's another question to investigate. Why would there be better intelligence? That certainly requires a certain connection on the ground. And how is that connection being made? So I think there are a lot of questions that come up from that.
So for my last question, you know, it's sort of a future tense question. You know, what do you see happening to the drone war? You know, will there be changes as sort of the United States sort of lessens its presence in Central Asia as sort of 2014 comes around and sort of, you know, our presence in Afghanistan, U.S. presence in Afghanistan and U.S. presence in Central Asia in general sort of, you know, tapers off? You know, what happens, what can happen to the use of drones in Pakistan? Do you think it would change, or do you think it would just, you know, it would just stay static? You know, there's no change in this case.
Well, I don't think that post 2014 American interests in the region are going to wane at all. I mean, you know, the idea that there's less of a physical presence certainly doesn't mean that there's less of an interest. You know, and certainly there, the American government has negotiated a fairly lengthy presence for itself in terms of its efforts with the Afghan with the Afghan state. So, you know, and there are issues left unresolved. I mean, for example, you have within Afghanistan, you have the presence of, you know, at Bagram, for example, you have the presence of third country nationals that are under American supervision in American detention at Bagram. And so, or the detention facility in Parwan, as they call it now. But, you know, there are some outstanding issues that are not going to go away past 2014. So from where I'm sitting, it makes absolute sense that there would be an interest in keeping the drone campaign going as a way to kind of, you know, maintain a presence without all of the manpower. Ultimately, I would imagine it would also be much cheaper. I mean, I know drones aren't cheap, but, you know, certainly cheaper than maintaining a sort of an army presence in the area. Would the campaign sort of slow down in Pakistan? It doesn't show any signs of slowing down, and I'm not really sure what would happen that would make it slow down. I am pretty sure that if there were some kind of change in policy, that it would be something that would come internally from the United States. Like, I can't see the Pakistani government sort of, you know, or the military or the ISI ever sort of being able to put forth a position that would compel the Americans to change their position on this unless or until, you know, the Americans themselves feel that this isn't something worthwhile. I don't know what that would be. You know, it feels like to me that the perspective of the Americans, the American government, is that this is a policy that works for us. And why would they stop it? And that's an interesting thing, too, because I think that the way that this conversation gets taken up in the U.S., you know, there's a debate happening, but I think the two sides debate two different things. And so it tends to get left unresolved. I think one side really is focused on sort of the moral implications of using this particular kind of policy. And the other side is more taken up with whether or not it's a good strategy for the U.S. to meet its own security goals. And it feels like as long as the answer is yes to the second question in terms of are drones a tool that help us meet our security objectives? As long as the answer to that question is yes, then of course they're going to carry on using it. Like, I mean, why wouldn't they? So, yeah, I mean, it's hard to speculate, right? I mean, it's hard for me to know what any one official is thinking. And the drone program is so highly centralized in the U.S. that it's, you know, it's really run by personalities rather than a system. So, you know, how do you change the system without changing the thinking of individual personalities? I don't know. As far as it goes in Pakistan, I think that the killing and the dying in Fata is part of a larger, I mean, it's part of a larger narrative of killing and dying all over the country. I mean, things are so unstable in terms of just people and their daily living. Like, I have family that lives in, but all of my family lives in Pakistan, and there's so many ways that they've had to adjust their lives living in the large cities. This isn't people living in sort of remote parts of the country. This is people living in large cities who've really had to change how they live their lives in order to help themselves feel more secure. And so when people get, that much, I think, taken up with their own personal security for legitimate reasons, I think it's harder for them to kind of worry about on in a sort of any kind of regular way, what's happening to people in some sort of remote mountainous region that they have never seen and probably never will. And that's sad. I mean, it's very sad. And because for me, ultimately, this is about this is about the people. This is about the individuals that are living there, that are living in this highly insecure area, who really don't have any options, right? Like, they're not in a position to move. They're not in a position to have any recourse. They're not in a position to really have anybody listen to their protests. And this is something that's being done to them purposely by their own state and by a foreign country. And it's not really given, I think, the proper consideration that it ought to be given.
Well, thank you so much. This was a great conversation.
Well, I hope it was useful.
It was excellent. Thank you.
Well, thank you.